Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Turbo Time podcast. I'm your host, Alyssa Maripodi, the editor of Turbo Machinery International. And today we're talking about a very hot topic in our industry right now, which is carbon capture and storage. So we're going to dive into why these facilities are at an all-time high, the roles of carbon capture networks and hubs, and then, of course, some of the challenges and hurdles that it's facing. So here to discuss this is Spencer Schecht, the Senior Business Development Lead at the Global CCS Institute. He actually authored our cover story for the May-June issue on this topic. So welcome, Spencer. Thanks for coming on the podcast today. I'm happy to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
Awesome. So let's just kind of begin with some background on the Global CCS Institute and its mission, if you can just start us off with that.
Absolutely. The Global Carbon Capture and Storage Institute is a nonprofit international climate change think tank. I'm based in Washington, D.C., and we have offices also in Houston, Melbourne, London, Brussels, Beijing, Tokyo, and Abu Dhabi. So truly a global organization. And our mission is singularly focused. That is to accelerate the global deployment of CCS and carbon removal technologies. We're a member-driven organization. We host a membership where 210 organizations are members across national and subnational governments, global corporations, private companies, research bodies, and NGOs, all committed to a net zero future.
So in the article that you authored, you had reported that there was 102% increase in scheduled deployment since 2022. Which is huge. So why is carbon capture and storage facilities at an all-time high? And is that increase largely a push, to reach net zero emissions?
Right. So at a high level, we need CCS and carbon dioxide removal to meet our climate targets to achieve climate neutrality. So while we require an all of the above portfolio of climate technologies and solutions, it is the versatility of CCS, the fact that it enables both emissions mitigation and removals that make it such a unique and important resource in our climate toolkit. So for instance, CCS can be applied across emissions intense industries, including the hard to abate sectors. So this includes steel, cement, chemical production, and power production to achieve decarbonization that is not otherwise technically nor economically possible. This enables the production of low-carbon hydrogen, and it also can be retrofitted on fossil fuel power plants or incorporated in the design of new power plants, providing baseload, low-carbon, dispatchable electricity. And also, when combined with bioenergy or direct air capture with permanent geologic storage, CCS is an enabler of delivering negative emissions, and we need negative emissions to scale massively in the years ahead. So this lays out a very clear picture. Carbon capture and storage and carbon dioxide removal must scale up to gigatons, which is billions of tons per year, to achieve our climate targets. And the strong growth in that CCS project pipeline that we've seen, that 102% increase, this is driven by supportive and enabling policy. CCS is becoming a more prominent feature of public policy. So this includes inclusion in a growing number of countries' nationally determined contributions, or NDCs, under the Paris Agreement. Also, more stringent general climate policy and regulation is sending a very clear signal that the world is looking to decarbonize across all sectors. So countries are starting to establish national CCS-specific targets and roadmaps. We're also seeing more global collaboration on CCS, as demonstrated by the Carbon Management Challenge championed by the United States, as well as a growing coalition of countries. We're seeing the development of international CCS business models. The first transboundary movement of CO2, actually, by ship for geologic storage occurred between Belgium and Denmark in 2023. And we're going to see that as a larger part of the CCS business model going forward. Recent growth in CCS project capacity has been concentrated in North America and Europe, where the supportive policy of carbon pricing is the strongest, as well as there being a comprehensive regulatory regime in place. But recognizing the absence of CCS regulation as a critical barrier to investment, countries in the Asia-Pacific region, for example, are now actively developing regulation to enable their growing pipeline of projects.
Okay, so what goes into building a carbon capture facility? And then, you know, what's the average timeline of construction on these?
There are many considerations that go into the development of carbon capture storage projects. And we can't cover all of them in a singular podcast, but some of them include questions such as what capture technologies are best suited to the emissions profile in question? What is the proximity of the capture facility to the storage site? How will those emissions be transported? So for instance, pipeline, barge, by rail or otherwise. Other questions include, what are the policy drivers that should be included in the consideration of the project? For example, here in the United States, there is the 45Q tax credit. In Canada, there is a variety of subsidies and tax credits, as well as a price on carbon. And this is also the case in Europe. This ties into one of the most important questions of all, which is, what is the business case for carbon capture and storage? It's also important to consider regulatory statutes, such as obtaining a Class 6 well permit from the Environmental Protection Agency if you want to store CO2 in the United States. And there are a small handful of states that have what's called primacy, so they can issue those permits themselves. Outside of technical considerations, it is critical to consider climate justice and environmental impact considerations to the local community. For these reasons, among others, a CCS project can take anywhere from 7 to 10 years from announcement to operation.
So what are the major differences between pre- and post-emission techniques?
Pre-combustion and post-combustion techniques for CCS refer to different stages in the process of capturing carbon dioxide emissions. Pre-combustion techniques involve capturing CO2 that was generated without combustion. This typically occurs in the gasification or reforming process, where the fuel is converted into what's called syngas, which is a mixture of carbon monoxide, water, hydrogen, and CO2. The water and the carbon monoxide are then shifted to carbon dioxide and hydrogen using the water gas shift reaction, and the CO2 is separated from the hydrogen. The water gas shift reaction involves the use of metal oxide catalysts producing a concentrated stream of CO2 and H2. This stream is fed into a pre-combustion captured unit where that carbon dioxide and hydrogen are split into separate streams. Pre-combustion capture generally offers higher efficiency because it deals with an inlet stream of CO2 at higher pressures, making the separation process less energy intensive compared to post-combustion capture. Pressure is a driving force for the absorption of CO2 in a solvent or sorbent. Now, post-combustion techniques capture CO2 from the flue gas after the fuel has been combusted. This process is applicable to existing power plants and industrial facilities, for example. The main step involves cooling the flue gas, separating the carbon dioxide from the flue gas using solvents, membranes, or other capture technologies, and compressing the carbon dioxide for storage. Amine-based solvents are commonly used to chemically bind CO2 from flue gases. Solid sorbents can be used to capture CO2 by physical or chemical adsorption, and membranes function based on differences in molecular cross-sections. Post-combustion capture tends to be less efficient compared to pre-combustion because the CO2 may be present in a dilute form in the flue gas, and this requires more energy for separation. But post-combustion techniques are more versatile and can be applied to various types of combustion processes without significant changes to the existing infrastructure. So post-combustion can be applied to process emissions, and they can be retrofitted with relative ease if sufficient space and utilities are available.
Okay, so earlier you made some references to carbon removal technologies such as direct air capture. There's the bioenergy with CCS and waste to energy. So how are those trending, and then where are they best applied?
Thank you for the question. Carbon removal technologies such as direct air capture or DAC, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, BECCS, and waste to energy, WTE, with CCS are gaining momentum due to the increasing recognition of their potential to mitigate climate change. So let's start with DAC. DAC technologies are attracting significant investment from both the public and private sectors. Governments and companies are funding DAC projects to scale up the technology. For instance, Climeworks and Carbon Engineering are companies in this space with projects in various stages of development and operation. Innovations are improving the efficiency and reducing costs of DAC systems. Policies such as the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act, which provides tax credits for carbon capture, are encouraging the development and adoption of DAC technologies. DAC is ideal for removing residual CO2 emissions from the atmosphere. This makes DAC suitable for sectors where emissions are difficult to eliminate. This includes aviation, heavy industry. We can offset these emissions from these hard-to-abate sectors with negative emissions through DAC. BECCS produces energy from combustion of biomass, and the biomass has absorbed atmospheric CO2. So then the combustion process here captures and stores that CO2. So it's a form of CCS with biogenic capture. This dual benefit makes it attractive for meeting both energy and climate goals. There are several pilot projects globally with a lot of plans for scaling up. An example here, we've got Drax in the UK. They're converting their biomass power plant to include CCS technology. Ongoing R&D is focused on improving the efficiency of bioenergy production, as well as the capture process. BECCS is well suited for biomass power plants, as you might guess. And this can be used to generate electricity while capturing CO2. It can be applied to the production of biofuels, capturing emissions that would otherwise be released during the fuel production process. Waste-to-energy plants with CCS are increasingly being adopted in urban areas to manage municipal waste while reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Various government and private sector initiatives are supporting the integration of CCS into WTE plants. For instance, projects in Europe and Asia are incorporating CCS into existing WTE facilities. It can also be applied to industrial waste streams, providing a way to generate energy and capture CO2 from waste that would otherwise be incinerated or directed to a landfill.
I think it's kind of interesting how comprehensive carbon capture and storage is, like how many things it can be and ways it can be applied.
Yes. And in fact, sometimes it's referred to as the Swiss Army knife in our toolbox.
Yes. Okay. Good analogy. Yeah, it definitely has so many different facets and ways it can fit into, you know, different industries and plants and stuff. So
future is very bright for the CCS industry. And as the IPCC and the IEA have noted, we're going to need a lot of CCS to meet those climate goals. And it's, again, that versatility where Today this technology can be applied across emissions intense sectors.
Absolutely. And in the article that you wrote, too, you had mentioned the networks and the hubs. So what are their role? How do they function?
Right. So networks and hubs comes down to scale and efficiency. So historically, a CCS facility was vertically integrated. So that means a single CO2 capture plant with dedicated compression, pipeline, and storage systems. But CCS networks are becoming the dominant mode of CCS deployment. Networks involve capture plants utilizing a shared network of transport and storage infrastructure. So here at the Global CCS Institute, we're tracking over 100 CCS networks worldwide. So networks where each entity typically operates only parts of the full CCS value chain provide several benefits. First, it reduces cost and commercial risk by allowing each company involved in the project to remain focused on their core business and not extend into areas of operations in which they have little or no competency. Networks and hubs create multiple service providers or customers. This greatly reduces counterparty risk. It creates economies of scale that would not otherwise be available to an individual CCS project, reducing costs. And this scale and use of shared infrastructure allows for a larger pool of capture facilities to be hypothetically integrated into a network. So CCS hubs are typically established in existing industrial areas where there's a cluster of emitters. And so this also serves to accelerate emission reduction in those areas, but also contributes to those regional economies. we've done some modeling here, and modeling suggests that up to 4.2 gigatons per hour of CO2 could be captured and stored by establishing 160 hubs globally at a cost of less than $85 per ton of CO2. And that $85 per ton is an important benchmark because that is the price of the 45Q tax credit as it exists today in 2024. So it's clear the development of CCS networks of hubs is critical for achieving the multiple gigaton levels of deployment for CCS by mid-century.
So you mentioned some of this earlier, but what are the biggest hurdles that CCS is facing?
There's certainly a lot of good reason to be optimistic, but scaling up CCS at the rate that we are seeing today is far from assured. Reaching the required scale of CCS is going to take a lot of work from actors across the landscape. So the role of government policy, the role of the finance sector is to provide the necessary capital. The role of the private sector is to invest in CCS. The existing pledges and commitments that we have seen presently, if delivered, can get us to somewhere between 300 to 400 megatons per hour. But we need to get to that gigaton scale globally. And in order to do this, we need to see deployment in emerging markets and developing economies. Capacity building, legal and regulatory framework development, and storage mapping are essential to accelerate this deployment. For CCS to be scaled up to the levels required, the highest levels of safety, environmental stewardship, accountability, community engagement, and the societal benefits need to be incorporated into projects. And while this can be considered the soft elements of a project, that by no means characterizes them as unimportant. Climate justice and concerns of communities need to be central and fully integrated into policymaking at the national and international level. Achieving the 2030 level of global deployment required also hinges on cutting project lead times. So we need to build projects faster. The adoption of best practices and developing CCS hubs and clusters should shorten lead times. Supportive policies that underpin robust carbon values, compelling and complementary tax incentives, and facilitating CO2 transport and storage hubs to attract more local capture projects would help maximize the number of CCS projects. The Global CCS Institutes also recently published a paper titled Building Our Way to Net Zero Carbon Dioxide Pipelines in the United States, which is available for download at no cost on our website. And the crux of this paper is that a lot of infrastructure is going to be required to bring us to net zero. And CO2 transport infrastructure via pipeline is well established and regulated in the U.S. More regulation to provide the industry and communities with confidence is forthcoming. And finally, early and sustained community education and engagement will be crucial for enabling pipeline development.
So to close out, what is the outlook for carbon capture at in-operation power plants?
CCS is a viable mitigation option for fossil fuel power plants when the power grid cannot be decarbonized. CCS can be applied to new power plants and retrofitted to existing ones. The new EPA rule for power plants in the United States is the first federal regulatory mandate among the federal policy incentives. The EPA rule recognizes CCS as what's called the best system of emissions reduction for existing coal-fired power plants and new baseload gas-fired power plants. This underscores the importance of CCS as a climate mitigation technology. The EPA rule is likely going to be challenged in the U.S. court system, so the ultimate impact on power plants in the United States remains to be seen.
This was so great. Thank you so much, Spencer. Thank you for sharing your insights. You have bottomless insights on this topic. I enjoy it very much. So thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. And just in closing, thanks again for having me. I will remind our audience that the Global CCS Institute, we're a nonprofit think tank, and our mission is solely focused on accelerating CCS deployment.
Thank you again, Spencer, and thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of the TurboTime podcast. I'm your host, Alyssa Maripodi, and we will see you next time.